Welcome back to Clinicians Brief, the podcast, the conversations behind the content. I'm your host, registered veterinary technician Becky Mosser, and I'm very excited to introduce you to today's guest. And we are going to have the pleasure of having a conversation that I think is particularly interesting with a Clinicians Brief editor-in-chief with the University of Guelph. This is a gentleman who has a lot of background and information. I'm going to let him introduce himself. But first, help me please in welcoming Dr. Weiss. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Oh, of course. Like I said, I'm very excited about this conversation. So tell us a little bit about your article and the background. Give us a little bit of background on how we got here today.
Well, for me, I just deal with infectious diseases, and tick-borne disease wasn't really on my radar at all until the last few years, because in Canada, at least where I am, we've been pretty blessed with not having ticks because we have a lot of cold weather. But with some climate change and other ecological factors, ticks are marching their way in. So ticks and tick-borne diseases have taken over a lot of my time in the last few years. And that's how we get here with the discussion of Lyme disease. What is Lyme disease and what is a positive test?
That's exactly right. And I think for just about everybody, we're finding more and more tick-borne disease interaction. But first, tell us a little bit about your background. Tell us how you ended up editor-in-chief and ended up at the University of Guelph.
Well, my background's a bit bizarre. I'm an internist, but I'm actually a large animal internist by training. But when I was doing that, I was doing infectious diseases in various species. So we were doing horses, but also expanding into wildlife and dogs and cats and things at the human-animal interface. And just as my career went on, there were more and more issues in small animals. So more and more of my time got diverted to small animal infectious diseases, which is the majority of what I do. And we do a lot of work with emerging diseases. And that's one of the reasons that tick-borne disease came in, just because there aren't many of us doing infectious diseases. And as this is becoming an emerging problem in a lot of areas, we identified a lot of things that we need to do to figure out what's going on. How do we diagnose disease? How do we manage cases? And how do we talk to people about all these issues in tick-borne disease? In terms of editor-in-chief, that was something that I got approached a few years ago a lot because I talk to a lot of people. I talk a lot. I write a lot. We have a blog called Worms and Germs Blog. So all those things kind of just came together, and it was a great opportunity to help continue to get information out to practicing veterinarians.
All right. So tell me, Worms and Germs. I got to know more.
So Worms and Germs Blog is a blog we started probably about 10 years ago now. And the idea was, it was pretty modest at the time. We were making information sheets, fact sheets on largely zoonotic diseases. And we wanted to find a way to get them to people as opposed to just making out printed copies. And we essentially just stumbled on the blog concept there. And it's taken on a life of its own, where we get regular posts on a variety of things about infectious disease. We have materials there for people. And we get, you know, a few hundred thousand up to a million hits a year there. So it's been a lot more popular than we ever thought it could be.
That's incredible. I love the title. And I think, you know, as, you know, being catchy title like that, but also I think it's something that we know we encounter a lot and we don't get a lot of education and background on. And if it can be delivered in some kind of interesting, fun way, I think it's very attractive. And so just from the title there alone, I want to get on that blog and read it. And then, you know, you question yourself when you're that attracted to something titled Worms and Germs, right? So, and tell me, I always ask, were you one of the veterinarians who always knew you wanted to be a veterinarian, or did that come on later in life?
Oh, I think it was always kind of there. I think it got reinforced as time went on. I always liked animals and liked science and liked the medical side of it. And everything just kind of coalesced as I got older. But I don't think I'm one that started off saying, I want to be a vet for, but I don't think anyone would have been surprised.
Okay, that's fair. And then what about internal medicine? Where did that start to creep into your mind as being somewhere you wanted to specialize?
Yeah, well, the medicine was a later thing. So I was, you know, interested in all things through vet school, kind of like a lot of vet students. And I was doing different species. And I graduated and went into mixed animal practice where, you know, my first patient was an iguana, actually. And my second patient was a beef cow. So a lot of variety there. And had a good time in practice, but then realized that there are some other things I wanted to do and get deeper into. And medicine was the area that really seemed to stand out for me as where I could go and get more advanced training and learn a little bit more.
Okay, I'm going to totally take a little side road here. What you just said, your first patient was an iguana, your second was a beef cattle. I wish that soundbite could go to kids, you know, middle schoolers, high schoolers everywhere as like a soundbite of attraction to the veterinary industry. Because isn't that the cool part about what we get to do, that we get to work with so many species and are constantly challenged in that way? And doesn't that really kind of get to the root of what makes us super passionate? And I would guess in internal medicine, you are still getting a lot of that different variant species.
Well, it's a nice thing about infectious disease, and it kind of continues along that. We're dealing with something new every day with infectious disease and infection control, the other area I work in. There's always something on the horizon. There's always a new challenge. And emerging diseases are a big problem. The things that I deal with now, you know, probably maybe the majority of them aren't things that were on our radar 10 or even 5 years ago. We've got a lot of new challenges that are coming up. So it's good to know, and it's somewhat intimidating to know that, you know, 5 years from now, I'm going to be talking about stuff, well, hopefully, but I'll be talking about stuff that's not really something we pay attention to now, or maybe not even a pathogen that we know about right now.
Wow. Well, that's such a great point. Never thought about it. I guess you kind of have to have a crystal ball. And I guess I'll ask you now, can I put you down for my zombie eclipse team? I feel like you're a very valuable member.
Yeah. Another major issue, right?
I mean, just something to think about. Yeah. All right. Well, speaking of emerging issues, let's talk about this article. And again, I found it very interesting. This, if you haven't had a chance, it came out in April 2019, Journal of Clinicians Brief, and it's the Borrelia burgdorferi seropositivity in a clinically normal dog. And I hope I'm saying it kind of right. That just rolls right off the tongue. Is that correct?
That's close enough. Yeah.
And so this is, you know, basically looking at what I think for a lot of people in general practice and maybe even specialty is a very common occurrence. And, you know, basically this is where we encounter asymptomatic dogs that test positive for different types of tick-borne illnesses, and especially for Borrelia, better known to a lot of people as Lyme, and much easier to roll off the tongue. And we all have that moment of like, oh, what do we do? Are we going to treat or not treat? So kind of guide us through that. You know, how do we decide?
Yeah, it's a big challenge. And there are two aspects of this. One is the medicine and one is talking to the owners, trying to get them to understand what it means, because it often gets talked about as a Lyme disease test when we're doing this screening, and it's not really a Lyme disease test. What it tells us is that this patient had a tick on it with that bacterium, and that bacterium went into the patient, and you know, the patient's immune response did something. But it doesn't mean that they have disease or they're going to get disease. It just means they've been exposed to an infected tick. And the good thing, what we know from dogs, is the vast majority of dogs, they get exposed to an infected tick and get that bacterium pushed into their bodies, they never get sick. But conveying that to clients that, okay, your dog's been exposed to this thing, Lyme disease is a high profile problem, they Google Lyme disease and they freak out, but realize that, you know, for most dogs, this doesn't mean anything. And if your dog's clinically normal right now, it's really not that important. There's nothing we're going to do to prevent disease at this point. There are a couple of things we can do to maybe make sure we don't run into problems, but it's information. It's not a diagnosis. And those are two separate things.
So it is a choice that you have to not only make as a practitioner, but you have to talk through the client and decide what the comfort level is, correct?
Yeah, they have to understand what the result means and what you're doing or what you're not doing. And that's the hard thing. Sometimes, you know, it's easy for us to do something because people want us to do something. We can justify doing something. Sometimes it's harder for us to not do something, even though not doing something is the appropriate course. And it's sometimes hard to get clients to accept that. It's just like your cat has an upper respiratory infection. You don't need antibiotics. Well, I want antibiotics because my cat's sick. It takes longer to explain that, no, you don't need it, as opposed to giving a prescription. And same thing here. It's easier to say, okay, the dog has Lyme disease than it is to talk about, well, it doesn't have Lyme disease. It's got antibodies to the bacterium, but it's not sick right now. So we're going to keep an eye on things, but we're not really worried.
So, you know, as long as we're not seeing those symptoms, and somewhat in the case of the article who outlines the case of Merlin, there was a positive test and it was in an asymptomatic dog. How do you educate the owners, and what is the need of education at that point? It sounds like we say exposure has happened. We may not be experiencing disease. Do we talk to them about possibilities of flare-ups? Do we talk to them about that dog as though they could be a Lyme positive disease bearing in the future?
Well, I think when we get a positive result, we need to, you know, think about it in the context of that animal right now and then risk down the road. So in the context of the animal right now, if they're clinically normal, that's great. So they don't have active Lyme disease. And we can tell the owners that and emphasize they don't have Lyme disease. Now, for thinking about down the road, that's where we get into two different discussions. One is, okay, if your dog is positive, it's met a tick, and that tick's hung out on that dog for a couple of days. So, you know, maybe we didn't get Lyme disease from that tick. We got exposure, but you must be being exposed to ticks. So we need to talk about tick prevention, because it's not just Lyme disease, it's other diseases. And just because you didn't get Lyme disease from that last infected tick doesn't mean you won't from the next one. So we need to talk about how to avoid ticks and how to avoid tick-borne diseases. The other side, which is a bit harder discussion to have because we don't have a lot of data, is Lyme nephritis. So, you know, the severe kidney complication that seems to be very rare, but it can be very bad. And we don't really understand that disease is the problem. We don't know how much of a risk a positive, healthy dog is for developing Lyme nephritis. We don't know, or we don't think there's anything we can do except monitor. We don't really have evidence it's an active infection. So giving antibiotics at this point aren't going to help us because it's an immune-mediated disease. But we need to talk to the owner about, okay, the tick prevention. Here's what we need to do to make sure we don't run into this again. And we also have to have a chat about, okay, there's this rare complication in the kidneys. Now, we're not going to do anything too intensive right now, but maybe we want to do a little bit of monitoring to make sure that doesn't develop, or if it does, we can pick it up quickly.
And so what does that monitoring look like to help us feel confident going forward we're monitoring that patient in a sufficient way?
Yeah, we don't really know what the best monitoring is. So typically what's done is looking at urine creatinine protein ratio. So it gives us an idea that renal disease is present. Now, if we see a change, it doesn't mean it's got Lyme nephritis, but it means it's something that's worth exploring. At this point, we don't really have anything beyond that. Ideally, down the road, we'll have things like biomarkers or other tests that we could use to say, okay, yes, you're at risk for this, or yes, you're developing this. But at this point, we're using a fairly crude test to tell us that we have something going on in the kidneys. And how often we do it? Again, another thing we don't really know because it is such a rare disease. And it's good that it's a rare disease, but it makes the information we have limited. So typically we talk about checking urine protein creatinine every 6 or 12 months. And then, you know, potentially over time, slowing that down. But right now, we just don't have a lot of data to go by.
And then, you know, that incredibly important piece, like you mentioned, is bringing in that prevention. And to your point about prevention, can we talk a little bit to the vaccine? And where does that tie into post-exposure, pre-exposure, and positive testing?
Yeah, the vaccine is another area we don't really understand well when it comes to an animal that's exposed. So vaccination, you know, it's a good line of defense. I consider it, you know, a second line of defense after tick prevention, because if a tick doesn't get on a dog and stay on a dog for a couple of days, it doesn't matter if they're vaccinated or not. But, you know, people can miss tick prevention. If they're like me, they forget to give it periodically. There are various things that can happen. So if you're in a high-risk area, or you've got an owner that's got some compliance issues, or an owner that's really worried about it, vaccination is a useful tool to give you that extra level of protection. Now, is vaccination good or bad in an animal that's already exposed? We don't really know. We don't have evidence that vaccinating a currently positive animal is a bad thing, though. And there's just not consensus on what the best approach should be for them.
And what about those positives when we see them come up? How long are they going to show that way after, post-vaccination?
Well, we're not going to see positives post-vaccination with most of the testing that we do. It depends on the test that's used, but the most commonly used tests don't pick up vaccine. Some will. So you have to know your test. You have to know if your test can be interfered with vaccination when you're trying to interpret it. If you're using a test that's not interfered with by vaccination, then obviously we don't need to worry about that. How long they stay positive after meeting an infected tick, that's another thing we don't really understand. We know, though, that if an animal is positive now, they can be positive for quite a while, and that might be years without reinfection. So if we test them this year and they're positive, we test them next year and they're positive again, does that mean they were exposed again, or does that mean the antibodies were still there from the previous time? We don't really know, because both of those could happen.
We have a lot to learn, don't we?
We have a lot to work on, yeah.
I love this conversation. I am completely geeking out on it, because I think this is so, you know, much of an area that we want to do the best we can in the industry. We want to do best practices for our patients, and we know overtreating is happening. We don't want to do that. So I think it's great information that's very valid to a lot of people out there. And we did talk to the point of prevention, and you know, in this article, you mentioned that Merlin was not on prevention, right? And I get crazy about this because I feel like we don't talk to our owners about tick-borne diseases as lifelong preventable disease, that, you know, once these diseases come along, that this is can be an issue for the rest of their life. But then cases like this come up where no prevention's used. We do see exposure. We don't see signs of disease. But what's, you know, how do we convince that owner, if they're not sick, to prevent something that isn't bothering them?
Well, a lot of it's just education, right? So prevention is an easy, safe, and effective way to keep ticks and tick-borne diseases away. One of the problems we run into some areas is when it's an emerging disease, you have a lot of people that aren't aware of it or they aren't used to doing it, and it's an extra cost that they haven't really thought about. So a lot of it's just the education. Here's what we're worried about, and this is why we want to do it, because it can, you know, can cause this in your animal, which can cause pain, suffering, rarely can cause severe illness, but it can. If your dog gets disease, there's going to be a cost associated with that. If we look at Merlin, yes, preventive would have cost him some money, but if we're going to monitor him a couple times a year for the next few years for proteinuria, we've probably paid for a lot of preventive right there. And the other issue is, you know, there are a lot of emerging issues with ticks, and there are new tick species that we're worried about. So what we're dealing with right now, you know, that's the baseline. Like, the tick issues we have right now probably aren't going away, but we're probably going to be running into some new ones as ticks change their ranges, or we see exotic ticks coming in that are imported. So what we have right now is just a baseline that could get worse. So let's try to prevent tick exposure in general so we can get rid of a whole range of tick issues.
And, you know, do you feel like I think this maybe seems obvious, but in your consulting, is it becoming more and more tick-borne illness? Are we seeing just a lot more of it across the country?
Well, I think it's certainly some areas it's fairly well established and it's maybe not changing much because the ticks and the bacteria have been there for a long time. But we're definitely seeing changes in patterns across the country. There's some change in recognition just because people are looking now and they're realizing, oh, actually, we do have this here. But if we look at tick surveillance, we certainly know that tick ranges are changing. And if we look at infection rates of those ticks, you know, those are moving with them. And what we see sometimes is you get ticks moving into an area, and then you have a little bit of a time where you don't have a lot of tick-borne disease, at least when we're talking about Lyme disease, because the bacterium has to build up in the small mammals. That's the main reservoir. So you get a bit of an early warning with ticks, and that's the time we really need to be talking about prevention. So once these ticks start coming in, if you're in an area where it's just emerging, that means we need to start paying attention to tick prevention, because very soon we're going to start seeing more and more Lyme risk. So let's try to head it off. And that's where tick surveillance and finding ticks on dogs, just the information we can pick up day to day in clinics by seeing changes in just that routine pulling ticks off dogs, that can help us identify trigger points for talking more about prevention. But once we've got ticks in the area, certainly we need to have a good talk about prevention. The other thing that gets missed a lot is travel, and dogs travel a lot. Yes. And travel doesn't necessarily mean traveling, you know, on a 5-hour flight. Travel means going from one risk area to another, and that might be an hour or a half hour. Some tick areas are very focused in terms of, you know, the ecology and everything. That's so you can be one area where you very rarely see ticks, but you drive an hour away and you're in a hotbed. So we have to have a little more discussion about risk of exposure of ticks and various things with travel. And we really need to explain what travel is. Travel isn't going on a vacation. Travel is leaving your property, essentially. So if you're just going down the road, that's one thing. But if you're going an hour or so away, especially into an area, you're going to a cottage where there's different wildlife around there, we need to be thinking about what your risk is. So you might not be a high-risk dog normally, but, you know, 4 or 5 times a year when you go to those areas, you become a very high-risk dog.
Such a good point. You know, I think you're right. We think about travel as crossing state lines, however we do it, but not taking that 45, you know, hour ride out to the lake and spending time, or 2 hours down to the beach, like we have so many people do here. And it's such an important conversation. And as a support staff member, as a veterinary technician, you know, our role is really getting that history and having the conversations with the clients and asking the open-ended questions to make sure we're talking about where pets go and what they encounter. So I love that you bring that point up. What are the resources? Where do you send folks when you say watch the endemic areas, watch for these blooms, get the messages ahead of time? Where do you send them?
Well, there are a variety of places that are out there. So CDC has some information within different states. So there'll be information. It varies with how much active surveillance there is. Some places there'll be active tick dragging where they're going out and trying to find ticks and testing them. Places where ticks are really well established, there's less impetus to do that because we know, right? We know there are a lot of ticks in Connecticut, so why would we bother dragging versus an area where ticks are expanding? So there's variable level of data. Some places we know are endemic, and you can see tick maps that say, okay, this is where you've got high risk for Lyme disease. Within that, the risk may, you know, vary from, you know, moderate to really high, but you can find a variety of maps on state or government sites. If you're looking at the disease rates, you can find that in a couple of different places. IDEX has a map that has, it's just the positive, so it's hard to say what that means in the context of overall risk. But if you want to know whether animals are being identified with certain pathogens, there's some maps available through there. CAPC has good information, the Companion Animal Parasite Council. We have a website called petsandticks.com where we're doing some pet tick tracking to focus more on Canada with a little bit of information on the US as well. So there are a variety of sites that are coming up with where you can find ticks, where you can find these diseases, how we prevent tick-borne disease is a really big thing, why we want to prevent tick-borne disease. There are some good resources out there that clients can be diverted to.
And I understand there's now even resources you can take pictures of the ticks and send them for identification. Is that right?
There are various ways, and it depends on your, and I don't know the US ones as well. We have them in Canada. We have some active surveillance going on where people will send us ticks as well. There are a few different systems now, though, internationally, where with certain guidelines, you take the picture of the tick, you send it in, and they figure out, you know, pretty well what it is. Certain tick species are easy, some are tougher. But I think for every veterinarian, every vet tech really should understand the basics of identifying a tick, and that's just identifying the main species that are out there. But knowing where those resources are for ticks that are harder to identify or strange ticks. And I think another thing that's important to consider is if you see an animal with a tick on it and you don't recognize that tick and you understand what ticks are, that's one that's probably worth finding out about. You can't just look at it and say, okay, well, that's not a blackleg tick, so we don't worry about it. I don't know what it is, but I'm not really worried about it. You know, most of the time it's going to be a tick from a wildlife species that's just happened to hop onto a dog or a cat. But we want to make sure that we're picking up any new ticks that can come in. There was that Asian longhorn tick that came in and is a big problem in the US, big concerns with livestock, but can also have issues for companion animals and for people. So we want to pick up any changes that are happening. So if you know what's there normally, that helps you identify abnormal, and then we can investigate that more.
That's exactly right. That's such a great point. You know, not just knowing the diseases we might be concerned about, but, you know, making sure that we aren't in an area that these emergent concerns are happening, because they're scary. And like you said, changes are coming. We know that things are probably not going away, but we know that new things are to come. So I will now put you through our Keep It Brief segment, although it rarely is brief, so don't feel too much pressure. Tell me what you think the biggest changes and myths are around ticks, tick-borne illness, and prevention use out there in practice right now?
Well, I'm not sure there are a lot of myths. I think a lot of it is just misunderstanding or lack of understanding at all. So we've got some areas where everyone's really tuned into the risks of tick-borne disease because they've seen ticks, and there's a lot of education for tick-borne disease in people. So they know that it's a concern for them. And we've got areas where it's an emerging problem and the knowledge is really sporadic. Some people know a lot about it and some people know nothing about it. So it's really important to understand your audience. Are you trying to raise the issue and, okay, well, ticks are here and ticks are bad? Or are we trying to be a little more refined in talking about prevention and diagnosis and things like that? So I think there's a lot of variation in what clients understand, and we have to be aware of that when we're talking to them. In terms of misconceptions, I think a lot of it is how do we deal with the test results, like we were talking about earlier. And the big thing really is remembering what a test result means. So if we're doing a screening test and we've got a positive antibody test for Borrelia, that just means the animal has mounted an immune response to the bacterium. So it's found a tick and it's had the bacterium in it, but it doesn't mean it has Lyme disease. So it's not a diagnosis. It's not the last step. It's maybe the first step in the pathway of talking to the owner about tick-borne diseases and figuring out whether this dog has disease.
Well, I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense, and it helps us know where we need to be improving and focusing in clinical practice. And I think, you know, for a lot of folks, it's, you know, it's not always sexy to talk about prevention. And we feel like, oh, you know, this client hasn't bought it for 5 years. And so they're not going to buy it. This year's no different. And we have to remember, we, you know, have to make those recommendations for every patient every time and be comfortable around those conversations. And remember that that's advocating for our patients when we provide that education and make those guided recommendations. So I think it's such an important conversation. And I thank you so much for being here. If they have questions specifically for you, is there a way that they can reach out to you, Dr. Weiss, or where do you direct people who want more information from you?
Well, I'm fairly easily accessible through email, through the University of Guelph. Through Worms and Germs blog, we have a contact tab there. People can send emails through. We also take queries through our petsandticks.com site with our pet tick tracker. So we've got resources on all those different sites, and I'm easy to get a hold of if anyone has questions to follow up.
And what's the address to the blog and the site?
So for Worms and Germs blog, it's just wormsandgermsblog, all one word, .com. And for our tick tracker and our pet tick information site, it's petsandticks, all one word, .com.
Perfect. All right. Well, thank you again so much for being here. Thank you for your article. And I cannot tell you how much I appreciate this conversation. I think this is an important way to protect pets for years to come.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks again to today's guest for joining us, and thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. While you're there, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review. We appreciate if you leave us all the stars. You can listen to podcasts as well on our website at cliniciansbrief.com/podcasts. You can find us at facebook.com/cliniciansbrief, on Twitter at cliniciansbrief, and on Instagram at clinicians.brief. You can also drop us a line at podcast@briefmedia.com. Clinicians Brief, the podcast, is a Brief Media production, produced by Alexis Ustry, sound by Randall Stupka, hosted by me, Becky Mosser, with special thanks to production assistant Michelle Monkrez.